I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
I don't know even how to introduce my next guest because he hails from the pantheon of heroes in the Marine Corps. And Woody Williams, I've seen videos about him. I've seen him describe the fighting on Iwo Jima that I've read so much about and looked at maps about. And sir, on behalf of everybody who listens to All Marine Radio, I can't tell you what an honor it is to have you on this program.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here, and anything I can contribute to enhance the Marine Corps and get information out about our foundation, our Medal of Honor Foundation that we have, I'm always happy to participate.
Well, let me tell you, they came up to me this morning and asked me, and they said, "Hey, Mac, Woody Williams will be over here." I said, "If I don't interview him, there's going to be hell to pay here." So, thank you very much for doing this. First of all, I want to talk about you. And then we'll talk about your foundation. I've read so much about you, but born and raised where?
I was born and raised in West Virginia.
How does the Marine Corps get on darken your doorstep? How do you hear about it? Why? I mean, the Army was huge. Marine Corps not so huge. How did you find your way to the Marine Corps?
Well, we lived way out in the country,
right,
and very seldom ever saw anybody in a uniform because we had no military installations anywhere near us. But during the Depression years, we had a couple individuals in the community, unrelated to me and unrelated to each other, join the Marine Corps actually to make a living. Because in my area of growing up, if you didn't want to be a farmer and you didn't want to be a coal miner, there wasn't a whole lot more to do except just plain labor. So they joined the Marine Corps actually to make a living. And back in those days, they only had one enlistment period, and that was 6 years. When you went for six. Yeah. But the armed forces, all of them, one time a year would give a person 30-day furlough, they called it. And they would come home then for 30 days. But that was the only time they got home the whole year. But the Marine Corps required those coming home from the Marines to wear their dress blue uniforms. And I've been told, which I was too young to realize that, but I've been told that they were using that as sort of an enticement because it was such an attractive uniform compared to that ugly Army uniform they had. That old piece of wool cloth.
It's the truth.
So the Marine uniform really is the thing that convinced me I ought to be a Marine. Had no desire or even thought about ever being in the military until Pearl Harbor was bombed. And at that time, I was in the Civilian Conservation Corps, which contained about 750,000 young boys around over the country, that to give those youth, we youth, something to do. And I was in that Civilian Conservation Corps.
So where did you go? What did you do?
Well, I ended up in a little town of Whitehall, Montana.
Whoa.
I thought I'd never get back home again. It's too far away. But
Montana's beautiful, though.
It is. But what we were doing there, and each state had different projects in it.
Right.
But in Montana, we were cutting pine posts out of the Rocky Mountain forest, making them into posts, building fence around government reservations to keep cattle and sheep separated. And because the sheep owners and cattle owners
right.
were leasing government ground for pasturing. So that's what we were doing out there.
And you were doing that when Pearl Harbor happened.
That's right.
And yeah. then what? You remembered those good-looking uniforms, and you said, I should probably do that. Girls like that, that's for me.
Well, yeah. And
because you would not be... That's a large group of people who joined the Marine Corps saying, who are those guys in that uniform? Yeah, you probably really don't want to do that. They're not the most reasonable people. No, I need to have that because that will help me get a girlfriend.
You're exactly right. Exactly right. They come home and take our girlfriends away from them.
Yeah, that's not happening. Not in that uniform. So when do you enlist?
I tried to enlist when I was 17. When the war started, the Civilian Conservation Corps was being discontinued.
Right.
We had a choice. We could, the Corps, the Civilian Conservation Corps, was run by the Army. We had an officer, Army officer, who ran the base. We had a first sergeant, mess sergeant, Army clerks. But they offered us the opportunity. We'd go straight into the Army from the CCCs if we were over 18.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we had to have a parent consent. I'm only 17. So I couldn't go. I wouldn't have gone anyway. But I still wanted to be that Marine. If I'm going to be in the service, I wanted to be a Marine. So I came home to join. But my dad was dead. My mom wouldn't sign my paper when I was 17, so I couldn't go. When I was 18, 1 month after my 18th birthday, I am now a man. I don't need mom's signature anymore. So I go to the Marines, and I want to go in the Marine Corps. I didn't want to fight a war. Didn't know anything about war. Never had a thought that I would have to be in a position of killing people. That just never entered my mind. I was entering the Marine Corps to protect my country and my freedom.
Right.
That's all.
Right.
Never knowing that I'd ever leave the United States of America. Because I didn't know anything.
Right.
You know. So... When I went in the second time, after my 18th birthday, to enlist, I filled out the paper, but the Marine looked at me and said, I can't take you because you're too short. They had a height requirement of 5'8". And I couldn't meet it. I'm only 5'6".
5'8"?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was the height requirement that time. And I have been told that historically, they tried to keep most of those 5'8 people on average so that they would look uniform. You know, you wouldn't start with tall people and go to the shorts. Everybody was basically the same height. Made you look, I guess, better. So I went on back to the farm. Then, in early 1943, when I tried in 42, that's when they turned me down. Early 43, they took the height requirement off and lowered it. And that same recruiter, he kept those applications that he'd had to turn down, and he looked us up, and he looked me up, came to the farm, said, you still want to go in the Marine Corps? And I said, yes. And he said, well, I can take you now. So, off I go.
So, where do you go to recruit training?
Well, I'm a Hollywood Marine and very proud of it. Because I tell these guys who went to Parris Island, we went to a tough Marine boot camp.
That doesn't start a conversation, does it?
Oh, I wish.
So you're there. MOSs. How do you get assigned an MOS, and where do you go after MCRD?
Well, when I graduated boot camp, I became just a grunt,
right.
You know, like most of us. And we first started training at a place called Jack's Farm, J-A-Q-U-E-S, and then it was a tank farm, and we were learning how to work with tanks. How does the infantry work with the tank people?
And this is 1943?
1943,
okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And I graduated in August, and so this is in the fall of 43.
Right.
We trained there for a couple of months, and then we went to Camp Pendleton to start our conditioning marches. We were marching 10 miles a day almost every day. And that was conditioning us for getting ready to ship out to go overseas. And
to sit on a ship for a month or two and lose all that. So it made sense.
For 19 days.
Yeah, it made sense to somebody. That's all right.
That's right, yeah.
So you were in 0311, your rifleman?
Yes, 0311.
Okay, all right. And so you head west, what year, what month?
November, I headed to a place called New Caledonia. And
now, are you part of a unit at this point?
Yeah.
So tell everybody what division you're about.
It was a replacement unit.
Okay.
Just call it a replacement unit.
Got it.
And New Caledonia was a center where they brought in the Marines, and from there they would disperse them or reassign them to the divisions that were already in the Pacific, and to fill in the slots or positions where they had lost wounded and killed. So... once we got to New Caledonia, we were sent to Guadalcanal to join the 3rd Marine Division, who was on Bougainville when we arrived on the canal. And we were headed for Bougainville.
Okay.
But before we got there, before they could get us there, the Marines on Bougainville secured the island, and then they came to Guadalcanal, and that's where I joined the 3rd Marine Division.
All right. So you joined them, finally meet them when?
December 43. Yeah.
So what do you do for the next year?
Well, in early 44, we received the flamethrower for the first time. Nobody had ever seen one. And flamethrowers came in great big wooden crates. And they had to have a group to train to operate the flamethrower. I was a bowman. I was in a squad. And I was a barman in one section of the squad. We had a 13-man squad.
Right.
And three people to a squad. Three people to a section. So I was a barman for that section. But when they when they created the unit for the flamethrower, then they said, you, and you, that's your volunteer, you know.
Voluntold.
Good word. You're going to be in this special unit. So they did then.
I thought you were supposed to be a big guy to have a flamethrower. I interviewed a PFC on Iwo Jima by the name of Cal Humphrey. He said, I put that flamethrower on. He said, I got rid of that thing in a hurry. He said, that thing was heavy.
Weighed 70 pounds.
They needed big guys for that thing.
But a short guy had a better chance of survival.
Ultimately, at the end of the day, yeah.
That's exactly right, yeah.
All right. So tell us about firing the flamethrower. What was that like?
Well, in the very beginning, when the flamethrower was arrived, or when they arrived, it had a bag of phosphorus powder with it. And it was to be mixed with gasoline, which formed a gel that we would put in the flamethrowers. And, of course, we had air pressure to force it out, but it was like shooting a water hose. You only had one stream going out there, and you only had 72 seconds of fuel in those tanks. You had 2.5 gallons of fuel, but if you opened it up and shot it, 72 seconds is all you got. So the gunnery sergeant that I had was an old China Marine, one of the toughest guys I've ever been associated with. But Gunny Hemphill, we tried that stuff, but you couldn't aim a flamethrower. You're firing from the waist, and you can't aim, and by the time you wandered onto your target, you're already out of fuel.
Right.
So he didn't like that.
Did it kick a lot? Was there a lot, when you unleashed it, was there a lot of pressure that moved the nozzle and made it inaccurate?
Yeah, you'd get an air burst that would push back on you, but it wasn't very... not much more of a kick than a M1 rifle. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
But it would kick back at you. But the problem was, you couldn't get it on target. And he decided, we're going to use some sort of fluid instead of this gel. And we practiced with the kerosene, motor oil, and finally ended up with diesel fuel. Because there are a lot of diesel vehicles, and we mixed gasoline with diesel, and the diesel gave it a body, And the gas, of course, gave it the flame. But we're only using 82-octane gasoline, which we use in all the Jeeps and trucks and that
right,
sort of
right,
thing.
Right, right.
Didn't burn very hot.
Right.
You know? And he wasn't happy with that either. So one day he came in with a 55-gallon drum of 130-octane airplane gasoline. Nobody ever knew where he got it, and he never did tell anybody how he got it, but we started mixing that with diesel fuel, and it really burned hot. I mean, 130 octane. So, finally, he convinced somebody that this is what we ought to be using, so then we could order it and...
And shipped, and nobody had to steal anything or lie to it.
Right.
Not that that would have slowed everything down, but...
So that's that was how we came by with the fluid that we used in the flamethrower's fire.
Interesting. What was the first operation? Was Iwo Jima the first operation you participated in?
Guam was.
Guam was.
Now, when we hit Guam, I had an assistant who was 6'6". Talk about tall guys.
Yeah.
Vernon Waters was my assistant. But I'm carrying the flamethrower. He's carrying everything else that I can't carry. My bedroll, my extra canteens, my extra grenades, my extra ammunition.
He's your valet.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. We had to wear a .45 with the flamethrower. That was our side weapon.
Good luck with that.
Good luck, yeah. I could throw a rock straighter and I could shoot that thing. But
isn't it funny when you see guys with pistols in the war? You're like, what do you use that for?
Exactly.
Right? Well, that's to shoot myself, just in case I'm going to get yoked up here.
Well, the first couple of days after when we hit the shore at Guam, I did carry the flamethrower.
Mm-hmm.
But we were trying to go up a hill called Nimitz Hill today. Wasn't that at that time, but that's what it is today. And we were having a difficulty. In fact, it took us 5 days to get to the top of that thing because they had all the advantage. They're looking down on us, rolling hand grenades at us and throwing mortars at us and all that. So after the first couple of days, there were no caves. Guam is coral rock, lots of it. Well, to dig a hole would be impossible. So they didn't have caves. And the bunkers that they had, or pillboxes, we called them, were on the beach. Well, after those things were knocked out, then they didn't have any pillboxes because we're going to the jungle.
Yeah.
So, I never used a flamethrower on Guam at all.
Oh, really?
Never. No. If I'd have used it, I'd have set the whole jungle on fire, you know.
That might not have been a bad idea. That might not have been a bad idea.
But, we just never had any occasion to use it. And I'll go back to my very basic, go 311.
There you go. Backbone of the Marine Corps.
That's exactly right.
And so you all finished that, Guam. And after Guam, where did you guys go? Did you stay on Guam?
We stayed on Guam. We put up tents, cleared an area, dug holes and made heads and garbage pits and all that sort of thing.
All that good stuff that Marines do. Who's the commanding general? General Erskine, the CG at that time or not?
Erskine. General Erskine.
Graves B. Erskine.
Yeah.
Graves B. Erskine. Marine Division.
And
so you guys stay there and train?
Huh?
You stay there and train, right?
Yeah.
Get ready?
But in addition to training as flamethrower operators, they also trained us as demolition people.
Ah.
So that we could blow up things as well as burn up things, so we had to know both things and or both occupations. And we first had just TNT, quarter pound blocks of TNT, as our explosives. That was before C2 or C1 and C2 came out.
Right.
And we would, in order to blow holes in the coral rock, we had to have crushed TNT. Because we couldn't dig it, so we'd drive use a Jeep rear axle out of Jeeps, sharpen them on one end, and use the cog on the other end, and we'd take sledgehammers and beat that thing in the ground for a little few inches. and then take it out and just keep making holes, and then we would fill those holes with crushed TNT. I would sit at my bunk with a box of 48 quarter pound box of TNT under my bunk, and I had an empty box that the TNT had come in, built very strongly,
right.
And I'd use that axle, the cargo on it, and I'd sit there and just crush quarter pound box of TNT. People that weren't familiar with explosives, they'd walk in the tent and see me drop a ring, they'd take off. You're gonna blow me up, blow yourself up. Yeah. But it wasn't dangerous. But then they came out with composition C2, and it was like a putty. So you could do almost anything with it. Previous to our, we couldn't get water on Guam, where we were. Up on the plateau, there was no water, and we couldn't dig wells.
So what are you going to do?
I don't know. Okay.
Somebody got to bring you bottled water?
Bottled water. Who ever heard of bottled water?
So, I don't know, you guys drink water.
No. Well, we all had tents.
Right.
And
it rained.
And it rained a lot on Guam. And we had to dig a foxhole just outside the tent by our bunk.
Right.
So that when Charlie came by, we called him Charlie, you know, he's flying an airplane, Japanese airplane. When he'd come by, we'd get a signal, siren would go off, and everybody had to go out of the bunk if they were in bunk.
Right.
Or if you weren't, just go to your foxhole and get in your foxhole. And sometimes it would rain, and you'd roll out of your bunk, you'd roll into the foxhole, and you got 2 or 3 inches of water in there. That don't make any difference, you know. Life is more precious than, you know.
Right.
But I used that crushed TNT to blow holes for heads, for garbage pits, oil pits, and that sort of thing. And then when Composition C2 came out, made it a whole lot easier because we didn't have to crush
right. The
TNT there.
Right.
We could just stick it down in there.
Yeah.
You know? And we had cut tops out of 55-gallon drums. And first we were doing a hammer and chisel all the way around to cut the top out of the thing so we could catch water rolling off of the tents on each corner. That's what we used to bathe in. That's what we used to wash our clothes in. Yeah, that was rainwater. And that was the only water we had.
And that was what you drank as well.
That's right. Exactly right. So that's how we survived with water. Now, they would bring water buffaloes in for the chow hall, and they had to go to the beach to get that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, haul it in. So mm-hmm. we needed more water than the buffaloes could furnish. That's why we put those 55-gallon drums almost every tent, right at the corner of all four corners, and we just had bukus of water because it rained a lot on Guam. Yeah. So we stayed there and trained, and then we didn't know, we knew we were going to go someplace, we didn't know where,
mm-hmm.
but finally, in early February, 45, you know, saddle up, we're leaving. Didn't know where. Everybody went aboard ship. And when we got to sea, then they brought out a board of some kind that showed the outline of Iwo Jima. Now, Guam was something like 19 miles from one coastline to the other coastline. They brought this thing out and showed that it was only 2.5 miles from one coastline to the other, 5 miles from one end of it to the other end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at that, and they're briefing us, you know, that we're going to be a reserve division to the 4th and 5th Division. We'll probably be gone no more than 5 days, probably never get off ship because they didn't think they would ever need us, another division.
Right.
4th and 5th is going to hit first. And it's only, as I said, 2.5 by 5 mile island. And it was so small compared to Guam, nobody could figure out, at least we peons, could never figure out why we were taking that little piece of rock. I mean, it didn't make any sense, really. Right. But eventually we learned, of course, at the airfield.
Right.
That's what we got to have, because we're losing B-29s flying from Tinian and Guam and Saipan to Japan. No way of rescuing them if they have to ditch.
Right.
So this was only 600 miles from Japan, and our fighters could stay there and escort the 29s to Japan and back. That was the purpose of taking the island.
Yeah. All right, now let me stop you there. Will you come? Will you agree to come back on by phone and talk about the fighting on Iwo Jima?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna hold your son to that.
Okay.
Because I don't want to monopolize too much your time today, and I know you have other things to do, and I want to talk about the marathon.
Okay.
My guest, the Marine Corps legend, Medal of Honor recipient, Woody Wood. And it's a pleasure to have you on. I can't tell you what a thrill it is, right? But I do want you to come on, because I'd love to do these longer interviews and talk about things like water on Guam. I don't know if too many Marines have heard that story.
Probably not.
You know, and we talk about improvise, adapt, and overcome, and you lived it in Guam, crushing TNT. Talk to me about this event. The Marine Corps Marathon. You're one of the Grand Marshals here. You and the Commandant are going to start races.
Yeah.
Talk to me about why you wanted to be a part of this.
Well, I've never had an opportunity. I've never been invited before. First time I've ever been invited to take part in it. Of course, I've heard about and read about the marathon. I'm not a marathon runner, or I don't go to marathon to watch other people run. It's just something I've never had time or never had the desire to do. But this marathon is so widely known all over the world. When you have people come from foreign countries running this thing, that says something about it, you know.
Right.
So I'm very pleased that I got the invitation, and I now see something that you have to see to believe, that all these thousands of people come to run as torture. They come to torture themselves.
Exactly.
That's a little difficult for me to understand.
Yeah, exactly. If they told us we were walking 26 miles, we'd say, what? Right? And these people are going to run it. But to follow up on a point you made, you walk into this room and you can feel it.
Yeah. Absolutely. There is a spirit running around here that you would not get anywhere else.
No, and it's unique because of the presence of Marines all over the place and all these organizations like the Semper Fi Fund, right? And I met a woman who started an organization called Medals of Honor, and they run for warriors that have been killed. And they run with their rank, their name, their service, and the date they were killed. They send that placard along with the medal they earn in the race to the family.
Wow.
Her son enlisted in the Marine when he was 17, and he's still alive. But she started doing this. She said the response was so overwhelming, this thing has just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And you run into these stories all over the place.
Right.
It's just incredible. So now, what's your official role? What are you going to actually do? They're going to have you fire a flamethrower to start the race? Are they going to let you shoot an artillery piece? What exactly?
Well, I was told that I was going to fire the pistol to start the race.
Yes.
Now, somebody mentioned to me a little while ago, Rick or somebody, that the Commandant had said that he wants to fire the pistol.
So the Commandant big-timed you?
Well, that was the word I got.
Whoa.
Now, that's unofficial, but I haven't verified that. So, but Rick said, well, we'll still fire you, maybe for the kids or something. They have two races here, don't they?
Right, 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 right.
Maybe for the kids or something.
They have one for people that hand crank.
Yeah.
Right? That, they have that race, too.
Okay.
And so maybe you'll get the fire. Tell them, look, I came to shoot something. Somebody better let me shoot something. Neller, you better let me shoot something, or I'm going to lock you up.
Well, I've done that before for 5K runs and that sort of thing. So I've had that opportunity to do that, but nothing like what this one is.
30,000 people. Unbelievable.
It takes a half an hour just to go by the starting point. Can you believe that?
No, I can't.
Yeah, I
can't.
Either.
I'm not one of these marathon people. Tell me about your foundation. I had a chance to meet your son. Your son, he's a good-looking kid.
Great grandson. I mean, not a great, just a, he's a great guy, but he is just a grandson, the oldest grandson.
So tell me about your foundation.
Well, we started the foundation in 2010.
Okay.
And we call it the Medal of Honor, Herschel Woody Williams Medal of Honor Foundation.
Okay.
And we named that to not only to pay tribute to those Medal of Honor recipients, both living and deceased, but we did it primarily to recognize and pay honor and tribute to the families, the loved ones, of those who sacrificed their life in the armed forces. Over the years...
Yes, so tell me what you guys do.
Okay. Over the years, Gold Star mothers have been reasonably well recognized. There are some communities that have already erected some tribute to Gold Star mothers, but nobody, in all my experience until I got involved in this foundation, no one had ever mentioned Gold Star Dad. The term was never used, expressed.
No.
So I ran into a Gold Star Dad, or he actually came to me, who had lost a son in Afghanistan. And he said that almost the same thing, that dads cry too. You know, his wife had already predeceased the sacrifice of the son. So who got the word? Dad did. They brought the word to him. He was the only one. And we just had never done anything like that. And the country as a whole, even with all the monuments and whatever we've got in Washington, D.C., there is not one thing that pays tribute to the families who have sacrificed one of their own for our country and our freedom. I just couldn't understand that. Why have we not done that? Because they suffered. They gave more than I did. They gave more than any of us did who got home. And we had never done anything to honor and pay tribute to those people. So, on our Capitol grounds in West Virginia, we've got a veterans memorial paying tribute to those that were sacrificed. And there's 11,424 names in that memorial, inscribed in granite. And every one of those individuals to have their name on that memorial had to sacrifice their life at the hands of an enemy. That's what the legislature said. If he had sacrificed his life some other way, like a plane crash or a auto crash or a heart attack or training accident, they weren't on that memorial because they were not killed at the hands of an enemy. That has been corrected, but no one had ever done anything in the country to honor the families, the Gold Star families, the relatives of these individuals who sacrificed their life. And most of us knew when we signed that document that says, I am enlisting, most of us knew there is a possibility I'll never get back home again. But that's war.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But why haven't we done something? Why hadn't we done something for the families, the loved ones who everybody related to that individual grieves because they lost a relative.
Right. Okay?
So I decided we had to do something in West Virginia, and this is awful hard for me to admit, and I'm not a selfish person, but we were doing it basically for a selfish reason, to honor our own in West Virginia. So, I was working with a committee organizing a veteran cemetery. And I mentioned that to this committee.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do something in this cemetery to honor those people on the families of those on that memorial. And they said, well, that's a great idea. You design it, and let's see if we can get it going. So I designed it, brought it back to the committee. They approved it. So we constructed the very first one ever in the United States of America in a veteran's cemetery in West Virginia to honor the families, the total relationship to that individual. And we thought we were done. We're finished. We've done what we were supposed to do. Let the others do whatever they want to do. If they don't want to do anything, okay. But it got on the internet, and the second one that came about was the son who lost his father in Vietnam. And he's a Gold Star son. And he said, this is Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. He said, we have got to have one of these in Valley Forge. Did you organize the committee, raise money, and they did it. That was number two. Number three was Tampa, Florida. A Jefferson School for Boys up to high school. There were 250 boys in that school. All boys school. No girl. Everybody boy. One of them saw it on the internet. Went to the guy in charge, their instructor, and said, we'd like to put one of these on the grounds of this boys' school. And he said, well, I'm sure we can do that, but we don't have any money for it. And whoever this young man was said, well, we'll raise the money. So they took on the project. Took them 2 years. They washed cars, mowed lawns, sold lemonade,
cookies, I'm sure, everything.
Anything. To raise money.
Motor oil.
Sold T-shirts, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Crushed dynamite?
No dynamite. But they raised $60,000.
Holy smokes.
And that was number three constructed in the country. And from there, it just continued to grow. Today, we have 44 communities all over this country, from California to New York to Florida to Texas and West Virginia. We've got 5 communities that have already put up one of these memorials. Number 6 is on the way. Number 7 is going to be on our Capitol grounds right near that memorial that have all those names on it of those who made that sacrifice. We've never done it before in our history. And now the communities are realizing these folks gave so much more than any of us.
Forever.
We must pay honor and tribute to that.
You know, so how do people support so your foundation supports all these different efforts. How do people, if people go to the website of the foundation, can they donate money there?
Oh, absolutely. We're looking for those.
You are.
Let me lay this thing down a minute so I can find a card.
All right. You just gave me one, and I have one. Is that that card? That's John Wayne. You gave me...
you see our foundation at the bottom.
Okay.
Anybody can contact that foundation, and we will send them information about the monument, all the schematics that they would need to do it. The only thing we can't send them is money. They've got to raise their own money.
Got it.
We don't have that. That's awesome.
So anybody who's interested in erecting a monument that honors Gold Star families.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to give you a website, www.hww, which are
my initials.
His initials, all right, mohf.org. Go to that, and you're going to find everything you need. And I'll put this up on our website. And but they're on Twitter, they're on Facebook. So if you just do a search on, if you Google Woody Williams Foundation, you're going to find a whole bunch of links that are going to take you to his foundation.
Absolutely.
So I'll tell you, that is all of us who've gone to war. You know, you come home and you see families and you know, the look in a parent's eyes is and there's nothing you can do to ease their burden.
No, no. Nothing. And it'll be there their lifetime.
All right. I've presented two flags at funerals in my life, both to the same mother.
And very emotional.
Oh, just horrible to think it could happen once. It's terrible to think it could happen twice. It's just heartbreaking. And they're great people, and we need more of these. We need more of these. So you're going to shoot some kind of weapon this weekend. We're not sure which race you're going to start in,
right?
Because Neller big time, yeah. So he was my I'm his favorite company commander.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Lieutenant Colonel Miller.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're battle buddies. We were in Iraq together. So, no, he's a good friend of mine, and he's been on the program a number of times. And so I don't want to take up too much more of your time. It has been an absolute treat for me to come on, and you promised me you're going to come back on and talk about Iwo Jima, because I just got a map in the mail the other day from a former commanding officer of the 11th Marine Regiment. He was given the map by Marines who were on Okinawa during the Iraq War, and they went through the archives of the 3rd Marine Division, and they annotated this map. And he heard me talking about how much I've read about Iwo Jima, how much I've watched, what a fan I am, and he sent me the map. But it was all folded up and kind of crinkled. So, because I love maps, I got my iron out. It is laminated, and I ironed it. And he heard me talk about it. He goes, Mac, only a geek would do something like that. He said, you must be an Iwo Jima geek. I said, no, you know, it was such a unique battle, right? You know,
yes.
You know, 60,000 combatants, no prisoners taken, them above, them below ground, you guys above ground. And I've just been fascinated by it, and I've never been to the island. I know a lot of people that have. I've never been there, but I would love to have you come back and talk about it in detail, because, you know, so you are a hero of the Marine Corps. A lot of us have grown up watching you on videotape, and now we can see you on YouTube. You're all over YouTube, and I've watched a whole bunch of those things. So, an absolute honor for you to come and talk to us, sir. And
thank you very much.
Thank you, Vince. And I'll tell you what, as great as your achievement with your mates from the 3rd Marine Division is, your foundation is just as great.
It is.
Because you touch the lives of people, families that have lost everything, and have told them, we haven't forgotten about you. We love you. We care about you. We'll never forget, and we want the community to recognize that. And we all know how important that is. So congratulations on this.
Thank you. One of the things that I hear very, very often as we dedicate these memorials is the expression, now, my loved one will never be forgotten.
That's awesome.
Amen? You
know? No, it's touching. Because they weren't just pictures. They were real people. And to those of us who knew them, to those of us who yelled at them when they farted and in our tents and things like that, their loss is heartbreaking and crushing. How long did you stay in the Marine Corps?
I got 20 years in. When I came out of World War II, the reserve units came into play about 10 years after I got out. So I got involved in the reserve programs and went up through the ranks and finally retired as a CW04. So I've enjoyed my life tremendously.
Well, it's been a rich one, and so proud that you're one of us.
Thank
one
you.
Of the few, the proud, the Marines. So.
Amen.
Thank you very much, sir. The one and only Woody Williams. What an honor. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be joined. You're going to meet a gentleman by the name of Mark Jones. He's a runner. So he's kind of reluctant about following Woody Williams, but he doesn't get a choice. He's got to come on. So we'll take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.